Anyway, we're here today to talk to you about a community-based exercise program for people with mobility impairments. We have no financial relationships to disclose, although we wouldn't mind having some so that we can do some more research. All right. So there have been many clinical studies in the research that have shown that exercise can improve strength and endurance. The big thing there is that they have small sample sizes and they're often only covering one diagnostic group. So that kind of led us to a research question about 6 years ago, I suppose. We wanted to know if those findings could happen in a community-based exercise program. There are a lot of challenges with community-based research, as some of you probably know. Often there's a pretty large attrition with the sample for a wide variety of reasons. People don't have transportation to get to your program, they fall ill, different things of that nature. There are often heterogeneous samples, because to get a large N, we need to get a lot of people in the door. Often there are no treatment control groups with community-based research. And there's difficulty sometimes with following up with the participants that actually enter the program. There are also inconsistent outcomes measures within community-based research in the literature. So everybody uses a little bit of a different tool to actually measure the outcome. And often for these community-based programs, there's not a lot of financial support for them to make them happen. And as far as the exercise programming is concerned, it's often inconsistent between the participants within a study because the programs are personalized and motivational for each individual person. In general, in the community, there's a lack of places that have accessible exercise equipment and space so that people that have a mobility limitation and might use a wheelchair could be involved in that type of programming. And there's also an issue with staff training. So oftentimes in the community, it's difficult to find staff that are well-trained in working with people with disability. So the other big challenge with community-based research is how can we assess the population with a minimal level of invasiveness? So we want to look at things like fitness, measures of self-perceived health, weight, heart rates, pain, and then we also want to look at the exercise impact, being endurance and strength measurement. Often in the research, at least at the clinical and research-based areas, those things are assessed with very expensive equipment, which is not always easy to obtain for a community-based program. The picture that's up on the screen right now is actually the physical location where our project took place. It used to be called the Enabling Mobility Center. We received some grant funding through Missouri Foundation for Health to start this program, and we were able to kind of design it from the ground up because we moved into a new building. So we were able to design the space with wheelchair users in mind, and it's difficult to see in the picture because of the wide angle view, but there's actually about 4 to 5 feet of space in between each piece of equipment and around the equipment, so it's easy to access. And after we lost our, well, not lost, but after the grant funding finished, I shouldn't say lost, when the program was finished with funding, Paraquad, which is a local independent living center, took over the wellness program, and they're still continuing today. Some of the participants that were in our program are actually still exercising. It's been about 5 years. So the grant funding also allowed us to provide some transportation reimbursement for our participants, which was really nice because within this population, people don't often have good access to transportation. A lot of them don't have cars, and public transit's not easy for them to access. We also had money to train our personnel, which consisted of occupational therapists, physical therapy assistant, and several OT and occupational therapy assistant aid students. The people that were included in our study all had a mobility impairment covering a variety of diagnoses, multiple sclerosis, spinal cord injury, stroke, cerebral palsy, and several others. They all used a mobility device of some kind, either cane, walkers, or manual power wheelchairs. They were all age 18 or older, living in the community, and capable of providing informed consent. We recruited them from local independent living centers, health facilities, and rehabilitation centers, and we also advertised in newspapers and newsletters in the community. So the graphic up on the screen right now is a brief overview of our sample and attrition and how they were assigned to the different groups. We started out with 348 people that signed up for a health seminar that we offered. 316 of them actually went through the seminar and completed a baseline exercise evaluation with us. And of that 316, we had to exclude 111 for a wide variety of reasons. About half of that actually signed up for the programming before we had our IRB approval, so we weren't able to include their information. So we ended up with 205 people who actually started the program, and 96 of them started, and then they weren't able to finish for a wide variety of reasons. I'm sure people out there can relate, you know, New Year's, have this resolution, I'm going to exercise, and then 3 weeks into it, you're not exercising anymore. So we did have quite a few people that fell into that. So we ended up with 109 people that actually were able to complete the full exercise program. So this slide here is showing our sample demographics between our comparison group of the 96 people who started and weren't able to finish and our intervention group. And their average age was very similar, 48 and 50 years respectively. And their income levels and education levels were also quite similar. The one thing that was significantly different between the two groups is that there were a lot less African Americans that took part in the intervention program. And we also took a look at our sample by diagnosis and device type use, and the most common diagnosis in both groups was spinal cord injury, if you don't count the other category, which includes a whole bunch of different conditions in there. And the most common device that people used was in the cane, crutches, or walker category. So there was no difference between these comparison intervention groups in terms of weight, body mass index, or resting heart rate. And the one thing that was different between the two groups was that the comparison group did report more average pain and current pain. So they were asked the day they came in, what's your pain level on a 0 to 10 scale? So they rated that they had more pain when they started. There were no differences in the baseline endurance measures and no difference in the strength measures, except that the comparison group did lift more on a one repetition maximum with one exercise. Our hypotheses for the research were that exercise would improve fitness, strength, and endurance for this population of people with mobility impairments. And the slide that's up right now just shows a very basic rendition of our research design. So before people started the exercise programming, they went through a baseline exercise assessment. We measured their endurance and their strength and asked them a few questions about their fitness. And they began the program and they were reevaluated at 3, 6, and 9 weeks into the program so that we could make individual adjustments to their exercise program as needed. And then after the 12-week intervention, they completed a post-intervention assessment of their endurance and strength. So the actual intervention program consisted of a 12-week-long exercise program. It was guided by each individual's personal fitness goals, so it could be a wide variety of things. Some people wanted to improve strength, some wanted to be able to push their wheelchair farther, and a wide variety of goals there. The exercise sessions were about 1 to 2 hours in length, varied within and across all the individuals, and they came 1 to 3 times per week. And their frequency varied across the 12 weeks, so 1 week somebody might come in once, another week it could be 3 times. There weren't any restrictions there other than what the participant imposed with their scheduling. The measures that we looked at pre and post intervention were actual body weight, body mass index, resting heart rate, a current pain level, and an average pain level in the past 30 days. The endurance measures were speed of arm crank turning on an arm ergometer and a rate of perceived exertion by the participant. And the strength measures we looked at were one repetition maximum on biceps curls, chest press, rowing, and a rickshaw triceps exercise. And I'm going to turn the presentation over to Dr. Gray to discuss what we found.
Thank you very much, Sue. So what we found is these people are, according to the charts, like me, grossly obese. They have a large body mass index. Their heart rate didn't change much, and it went the wrong way. The current pain dropped almost immeasurably, but the average pain for the last 30 days showed a drop of 32%, which is not too bad. Is someone doing the slide a little bit? You are. Thank you so much. If I'm not going to turn my neck on that. Okay, so the next thing is, this is an actual participant working away at the arm crank, and the initial test, the baseline was 9 minutes, and I did this. This was not a lot of fun for yours truly, pushing something like a hamburger for 9 minutes. And what made it worse is just when you thought you were getting it down, they increased the resistance after 3 minutes. So, but you know, I was like, oh, I don't think I can do this. And then they said, well, why don't you give me an estimate of your rate of perceived exertion? And I said, what's the highest penny? 9 minutes. Is there one for Bill? So we took the speed measure and the endurance, the perceived endurance measure. And we go to the next slide to see what happened. We did okay on the arm speed for the first two, and they were all in the right direction. I wouldn't write home about a 10% change, but at least it was something, and I suspect if we kept doing this, you know, it might have some more effect. The rate of perceived exertion. Now, Sue thinks that first one, even though it was in the right direction, it went down. She thinks that's a warm-up effect, and then you really get going on the second one. There's some truth to this from the way I do it. You have to, when you first start to go out and run, I was a runner. It's pain, right? Nobody wants to do it. And then you get into the zone, and you do a lot better. So I think that, but then at some point you get exhausted, and so there's that kind of curve. So anyway, we got 13% change there. I'm not so sure that is the best measure, but it showed something, so we kept it. Yeah. All right, then the next one is the upper tongue. And this is a great machine. You can do about 17 different types of exercise. And it's so good that yours truly bought one. And as I am in the basement. And I use it from time to time. I'll tell the truth soon. No. Anyway. So this was a one rep max for biceps, left arm, right arm, chest press, rickshaw, rowing both sides, you know. So if we go to the next one, you can see that was pretty darn good in terms of increasing strength in 12 weeks from approximately 20% to almost 40%. So even with my limited statistical knowledge, I would say if you were to reach into the hat, they're all black balls, so the probability of getting a white ball is zero. So I'd say we did okay in that, right? Now I don't have the slide that showed a comparison between the cane crutch walker group, the manual, and the power chairs. Interestingly enough, there were very few differences when you grouped them that way. In the diagnostic groups, spinal cord arthritis did the best, and who would you guess did the worst? The MS group, which is what you. Those slides are so big they take two screens. Anyway, okay, so much for statistics, and let's talk about meaning. I teach in the occupational therapy program, so we always have to talk about Sheldon, who's in the second row there, he knows these people on a one-to-one basis, and one of them was a woman named Sandy, and she said, I was scared to come out of the house, and I used to carry pills, I was scared to exercise, I lost 40 pounds, discontinued my diabetic medicine. Of the 109 original participants, the average number of weeks they continued to exercise after the 12-week program was 51 weeks, which is basically a year. And we have people who've been here for 5 years now. And that's just a few, quite a few. And there's some other anecdotal things. Mike would always ask him, why do you keep coming here? And in a nice way. And, you know, if you have to take a 2.5-hour ride on a bus, you ever done those dial ride or pray for a ride? Transportation systems, I'm telling you, it's an ugly thing. Anyway, you have to stop all the time, pick up other people, let them off, and by the time you get there, you're like, phew. But they come, and they come because in this population, you saw their average income, you know, about 50% of that earn less than, or have an income of less than $15,000. So going to a gym and working out and being around people that are somewhat like you is a big deal. They think they've accomplished something, which they have, and they buy into it, so like a belief system. Well, if I'm here, it's got to be good, and so they start to believe that exercise is good for them and it sustains them. And so they come for social, they come, they feel better, they're more relaxed, and they feel like they've accomplished something. If we were to do this again, we would probably do a little bit more with blood pressure and tracking their drug regimes, because when you do group studies, you don't really get to see some of the more significant things like people going off drugs and getting out in the world and doing things. So the next slide, which is up there, is how does this fit into a grand scheme of the ICF? And a community-based research program lets you look at activities, participation, environmental factors, and personal factors. Whereas if you just do it in a clinic, you're a little more limited to maybe impairments and activities. And so that's our frame of reference for doing the study. Now, the next slide, real quickly, is I could get into some serious controversy here. There's a dialogue in the literature about rigor versus relevance. And I used to be more on the rigor than the reality of what goes on in life. And the further I age, the more years I put on myself, the more I think, you know, relevance is really what we should be doing. But you have to give up some of the rigor. So is it okay to give up the rigor of a control group? You saw that we dropped from basically 200 to 100. And in most studies, that would be considered a failure, 50% dropout rate. Except if you look at the base rate for the whole population, my bet is that 50% of people staying in an exercise program is pretty high. But why don't you have a retest for the people who dropped out? Does anybody do this kind of research? Because I'm telling you, we had their phone numbers, we had their addresses, we had another contact person in case something happened to them. And after 1 month, you cannot reach these people.
Right.
I don't care. It might put a little finder on them, I think it's still the community. We have a lot of trouble there. It's a highly mobile group, and they're all worried about who's calling for what reason, because usually when they get a call, it's a creditor or they're being asked to move. Anyway, so that also covers sampling frames. Who do you sample? I would submit that the clinic population, a lot of the research is done on are people who get health insurance. A lot of it's not just Medicare or Medicaid. So a lot of the stuff, they're missing a significant part of the population. I don't think you're going to get too many people on. Okay. You're not going to get too many people with VO2s. You're not going to get people to show up all the time. You can't just do a single intervention. You've got to do a bunch of them. So the last slide, if you can read yourself, but bottom line is community-based research is pretty tough. And I hope that some of you will spend your life doing it and answer a bunch of those questions, because I think it's time to get relevant. That's it.
Okay. Thank you, David. You know exactly where you're at with that kind of research, so you're right. 50% is an excellent.
I'm just going to say that most of this was inspired by you.
No, no, this is not me. But it's really important research, because you're right. 50% participation is enormously beneficial in a population that's, you know, very sedentary and has enormous barriers to participation.